Susan, I hope you brought some other kind of clothes along. You know, we're going to the country, not to a tea party.
No, I did. No, I didn't, but I brought flowers to brighten up the house. Case, it's gloomy from being shut up so long.
Flowers? You brought flowers to the country? Susan, I hate to disillusion you, but flowers do grow wild. There'll be plenty of them up there already. Incredible.
I should have told them to turn around and take me back home, but I was too afraid to. All they did was to look at each other so strangely. I don't know why I got so upset, but after a while, I felt like I just had to get out, and I couldn't. I couldn't get out. Diane and her friend, they think I'm a fool.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price, welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be necessary. Possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price, the man behind not only the Forgotten Horrors franchise, but also the Comics from the Gone World, which I've certainly been enjoying the Ghost Gallery here just lately.
But, crazy stuff, eh?
Yeah, well, and a number of incarnations that you've... You've turned that every way but loose.
Well, it's a never-ending process. I just got a pristine set of scans in on a new discovery that Charles Biro did.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
the crime does not pay guy, yeah?
Well, it's a children's book called Uncle Charlie's Fables.
Wow.
And it's damn near as good as Walt Kelly's kid books for Dell.
Did Lev Gleason have anything to do with it?
Publisher? Yeah.
He did publish.
Yeah, it's Biro was in charge of the cover paintings, and he had a good stable of interior artists, and I've restored a couple of the covers for front and back covers of a new and comprehensive edition, and couldn't resist. On the back cover, we used the Crime Does Not Pay logo. And the slogan on the back is, even in storybook land.
Was this a comic or a comic book like the other stuff?
It was a five-issue comic book series.
Oh, be darned.
And so we've got this back cover painting of a brave knight or Robin Hood type, a brave scoundrel, outrunning the armed guards of the king with his sword at the ready and a kidnapped maiden by his side, and he's saying, come on and get me, you dirty coppers.
little bit of that cognitive dissonance, isn't it?
That's right.
All right, speaking of cognitive dissonance, our producer, Joey Hambrick, chose the film and the short subject that we're going to be talking about this evening. And, you know, we'd like to think we're a little off the beaten path, but Joey was out there in the shrubbery somewhere with these. However, I was amused by both of them, and I hope that you were too. I guess we ought to start with the one that features your distant cousin, Vincent Price, the film called, or the short subject, actually what was an hour-long TV show, I guess.
Yeah, it's like a little documentary.
Strange but True Football Stories. Now, I have to admit, when I think of football stories, it would be a long time before I thought about Vincent Price in conjunction with those football stories.
Last thing I would have considered, and I don't think that ever came up in our conversations, I hadn't seen the thing.
No, I hadn't either, and it was obviously toward the end of his life. I mean, it was very late in his career.
Yeah, 1987.
Right.
Yeah.
And was he? Did he made a couple? He made The Offspring after that, maybe.
Well, he made The Offspring, or also known as From a Whisper
From
to
a Whisper
Scream.
To a Scream, right.
Made The Whales of August, a very serious dramatic role with Lillian Gish and Betty Davis.
Right.
And then appeared in Edward Scissorhands right at the end.
That's correct. Sure, sure. So this is before all of that. And it's, I guess it was kind of hard to find. I assume it was an NFL, sanctioned project. And
NFL had some very unusual talents working for them in that period, including Jack Davis.
That's right, as the artist Jack Davis you're talking about.
Yeah, who did football pro team mascots and college team mascots in that same Mad Magazine style.
Mm-hmm.
So
well,
it's not all that. Well, it's not inconsistent with their Vincent's career or Davis's career. It's just applying it to an area that one wouldn't really suspect.
Although I have a feeling that Vincent Price is part of it. I mean, he could have been talking about midget auto racing or anything else. You know, I mean, he was kind of brought in to do some stuff. He talks about doppelgangers. And I mean, I don't think he uses the term doppelgangers, but he uses the term, what does he call them? It's the theme of the double is a staple of fantasy fiction is one of the things that he says.
The ringer.
Yeah, the ringer, right.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
there's
it's
all these
a very peculiar thing.
Yeah, yes. And there are all these weird sets in this, and then you set it up with old Frenchy Fuquay saying, "Sometimes pro football is like the Bermuda Triangle. Things happen that can't be explained." And I just really, you know, Vincent does give it his all, and he does a really good job at it. It's just, it seems sometimes that he's in another movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was working at the time. This would have occurred, this production of Strange But True Football Stories would have occurred right after he had, oh, gosh, what was the occasion? Oh, yes. He was touring at the time as basically a stand-up comedian.
Really?
Oh yeah, doing a very scholarly lecture, but playing it like a nightclub comic.
Now is that the Villains Still Pursue Her?
That was the Villains Still Pursue Me and the simultaneous one-man Oscar Wilde show.
I see.
Oh yeah. And,
did
and,
you
and,
see any of those, either of those shows?
Oh yeah, yeah. That's how we met. I was George Turner, and I went to do a newspaper interview with Vincent in 1974 when he was doing the Villains lecture at West Texas State Cow College,
mm-hmm.
And that's when we discovered the family connection. He was on, completely on, not trying to be funny,
mm-hmm.
Like, say, Robin Williams would do in an interview, but being very funny just by being straightforward and matter-of-fact and amused at everything.
Right.
A waiter at the college campus reception offered him a Coca-Cola, and he said, "Get that away from me," and turned around to us and said, "Haven't been able to drink Coca-Cola since they made me immerse myself in a vat of it for the wine drowning scene in Tower of London."
Oh, wow. Oh, how nice. Well, as I watched this film, it struck me that Vincent Price was a little analogous to Bela Lugosi in Glenn or Glenda.
Oh, yeah.
He's
yeah,
kind of a disin...
pull the string.
Yeah, pull the string, dance to that which one is created for. But he didn't say that, but he said stuff like, "Something magic happens when the circus comes to town."
Oh, yeah, and the delight he takes in football puns.
Yes.
The Immaculate Reception.
Yes, yes. Which is a staple, of course, of that. That's referred to, I guess football fans refer to it that way as well.
And, oh, yeah.
And, but he, he kind of does, and at the end, did it seem to you he was doing a little knockoff of Karloff in Thriller?
Oh, yeah.
When he's
doing
that narration?
So. As I kept expecting him to say, as sure as my name is Vincent Price.
That's right. Exactly. Well, it came out in 1987, and Joey, is it hard to find? Is that a hard, is this a hard?
On VHS, I don't, it's like $5 or something on Amazon that I was able to find.
You found it for $5 on Amazon on VHS copy. Strange but True Football Stories, folks, if you want to check this out a little bit more than just listening to us talk about it. It's, if you're a football fan, I think, you know, I like pro football, and it was fascinating to me, but it was almost, I almost got whiplash going back and forth from football to Vincent on those odd sets, you know.
He's having fun just the same way that Carmine Infantino and Julius Schwartz and Gardner Fox had fun with those strange
sports
story comic books.
Yes,
yeah.
You're absolutely
which
right.
I have always suspected may have had at least a marginal influence on the Satan Mart story you did.
It's certainly possible. I never thought about that before. But
you know,
I mean,
subliminal influences are where you find them, of course.
And when
I first read that story, and I think it was Kitchen's Death Rattle.
It was in Death Rattle, and then later on reprinted in Kitchen Sink's Baseball Stories, right?
Baseball, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it had that same very off-the-wall, almost a moralistic vibe.
Oh, I was being definitely. I had something, you know, I had something to say with that story.
Oh, yeah.
And that was for folks who don't know what we're talking about. I did a story with Jim Milloway, and I scripted a story called Slide Center Slide, which appeared in Death Rattle quite a while back, and then later on was in Baseball Stories, both for Kitchen Sink Press. And it was because it's like in Strange Sports Stories, and of course I grew up reading Strange Sports Stories, and there's an otherworldly vibe there that I think maybe, and I never thought about that, Michael, honestly, before, but you may be right. I may have.
Well, you know, I still mentally refer to Strange Sports Stories. Not necessarily to any practical purpose, but I often flash back to those stories because they were really some of the best work that Schwartz ever did, and they were consistent with his science fiction titles at DC Comics, but they also were kind of a Rod Serling attitude to them.
Very much so. And of course, Rod Serling, you start thinking about it, he worked with baseball. What was the wonderful baseball story he did for Playhouse 90? Not the Great McGinty, but I can't remember which one it was.
I remember the title escapes me, but yeah, there's and so many of these things. For one thing, hiring a talent like Vincent Price to do a documentary of subject matter you really wouldn't associate with him.
Yes.
Kind of like that pseudo-documentary that John Carradine did called The Best of Sex and Violence.
With all the trailers, sure.
Yeah, it's like pictures that, with a few exceptions, you wouldn't associate John Carradine with.
Well, vampire hookers and you would, but yeah.
Vampire hookers, definitely. Uh-huh. But then he devotes a large segment to Rudy Ray Moore's Dolomite movies.
Yes.
And throws in these great puns that you can pretty well tell he's just kind of making it up while the film rolls.
Yeah.
And I get that feeling out of Vincent in the football documentary.
But he's just so suave, isn't he?
He's going for the unsettling and weird, the one-eyed quarterback,
right?
The raw meat eating player,
right?
The morbidly obese player,
right?
Things
right.
like this.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. Yeah,
and the utter superstition of so many of the players.
Right, right. Even though really baseball players are more superstitious than football players,
yeah.
Still. But it was an interesting, I think, as can be used, kind of wielded like a club, that term. But
yeah.
it was an interesting picture. And speaking of interesting pictures, Deathbed.
Oh,
The Bed That Eats.
Yeah.
From 1977. Michael, I don't know where to start on this one. Do you know where to start? I do have a little theory about it, but I'd like to know if you want to approach it in any sort of an oblique way before we get into this.
I'm flabbergasted. I find it very closely kin to a lot of other, not necessarily industrial peril, but inanimate object peril.
Indeed. And also
you
close,
see that going all the way back to Disney, when in the old mill, for example, about all these mortal perils that occur in an old windmill, the endangering the wildlife that has taken up residence in this ancient mill. You see that in a Popeye cartoon.
Yes.
Actually, more than one. There's one that takes place in a foundry. Where Sweepy gets away from Popeye and goes wandering, crawling through this factory and is just damn near crushed by everything whose path he crosses, and yet not. More recent times, what would this fall into? The refrigerator. The lift about the homicidal elevator. Things like that.
Right. Things in your environment that turn against you. And what better than a bed? You know, I kept getting the idea that there really was a militating, if that's the term, intelligence behind this film. And that eventually it was all going to lock into place and make sense. Now, I would say, I want to float this theory and see what you think, because we haven't talked about this, but I see parallels very much to a film we talked about a couple of episodes ago called Lamora.
Oh, yeah.
In that it is this combination of art and exploitation that I believe goes clear back to the 50s when art films, air quotes around art, but art films first started showing up in America, and the neighborhood bijoux wouldn't touch them. And so these theaters came along to play films that might show a flash of breast or things outside the MPAA, or the MPA at that time, I guess. But the code, the MPAA code. And so these theaters came up to play the art films from Europe and the things that were a little bit more adult, I suppose. And then in the mid-50s, people like Russ Meyer and our friend, our good friend Dave Friedman, and others started creeping in with
dementia.
With these nudie movies. And to me, that conflated art and exploitation in the public eye.
Very much that. Yeah, a lot of the Russ Meyer pictures had artistic pretensions.
Yes. And this picture has an artistic, even though they flash a lot of breast and stuff at you, and this film has an artistic pretension, I believe. Especially
no,
when you we have a narrow, it's essentially, I don't know, I'm usually the guy that does the quick synopsis, but a quick synopsis of this picture eludes me. It's about a bed that eats people, which you can deathbed the bed that eats. It's in a house, and people go to this house, and eventually some of them lay down on the bed and get eaten in graphic, strange detail. And then there's also apparently a viewpoint character behind a portrait in the room where the bed is, who is acts as a sort of Greek chorus to tell us what's going on. That's pretty much all I can tell you.
And the purported narrator is just as much of a dumbfounded bluff as the film itself.
Exactly.
It's a George Berry did not make too many films. He did a kind of a remake of Deathbed as a video production.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Some years after the original. The original was shot like in 1972.
Yeah, it was really early. Yes, that's right.
Inability to pay lab fees tied it up until, oh gosh, the 70s. And I don't think it really saw much of a release at all until maybe the, well, very recent years.
Yeah, he mentioned that there was, of course, in this little prologue that's on the DVD release, raises more questions than it answered. For instance,
right.
Like, why did you do this is the main question. But he talks about how, you know, there were some theatrical releases that he didn't know anything about. And I guess maybe it was, you know, it had made a pretty good drive-in film in the late 1970s. There was enough nudity, and it was
sure.
Like, you know, who was it that talked? Joe Dante and Arkish talked about when they did Hollywood Boulevard. They said you just needed to make a drive-in film. People look up and see some action that's going on. They kind of follow it, and then they look back up again, and it didn't have to be that linear. And that's kind of what The Bed was. It was a pretty good drive-in film. I don't think it ever, obviously, George Barry never made any money out of it, but he just kind of talks about, well, we did this, we did that, and he doesn't get behind saying, you know, how this came together. Why did he do this picture? What was, there
no.
Really does seem, there are glimpses when there's this real intelligence behind it.
Man, oh man, I think it's revealing. I do believe it's revealing that Brad Jones, who bills himself as the cinema snob and does a kind of a serialized video production, chose this for discussion in one of his episodes.
Oh, really?
Of the cinema snob,
mm-hmm.
And that would have been what, about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yes,
the cinema snob is. As played by Brad Jones, and I think it's kind of he's playing himself, basically.
Mm-hmm.
He's an art film critic who devotes intellectual exercises and film theorism
mm-hmm.
to some really, like, known, badly made movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not much of a stretch to say that he's treating these things as art.
Yes.
And he's not ridiculing them so much as he is looking for the art hidden beneath the schlock.
And does he find some in this picture?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's I haven't seen the episode in, well, gosh, I think it was Cablecast. About 2010.
Mm-hmm.
2010. And I don't, let's see, I don't believe I've got a list of everything he's done. But the trademark is to take these pictures considered to be inept or bad,
mm-hmm.
and instead of giving them that stupid Mystery Science Theater treatment,
right.
He gives them a scholarly discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this film, like, really gets flabbergasting.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, it does have art film elements, but again, I take it back to that whole cultural memory that we have with that conflation of art and exploitation. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, Corman was the one who was able to figure that out. I mean, when he was doing...
Oh, yeah, many of his...
Yeah.
A Bucket of Blood is an art film.
It absolutely is an art film.
You know, Little Shop of Horrors has art film pretensions.
It does. It absolutely does. Last Woman on Earth.
Definitely.
I mean,
yes.
Last Woman on Earth is an art film in its way. But he also mm-hmm. knew that he had to have more, crowd-pleasing elements in the film in order to get the art part across, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that whole thing, again, goes back to art and exploitation. And this has art and this has exploitation, and it's just a curious and not completely successful mixture of those two things.
No, I wouldn't call it successful in what it tries to do, but what it does accomplish is, I guarantee you, I don't think anyone who sees it is going to forget it soon.
No, you don't forget the picture. Which is, you know, is that a criterion of art? I mean, I don't know. Just because you don't forget it?
Yeah, and who gets to call it art anyway?
That's true.
That's the lingering question. It's like, well, okay, I consider Ed Wood to be a form of art, not the Tim Burton film so much as the artist Ed Wood.
Right. Right.
Because he really fancied himself an artiste.
Well, Joey and I were talking about that, as a matter of fact, just before we did this podcast. And, you know, I remember running into something when the Ed Wood mania was at its height. And it was, I think, a program book or something from UCLA. And they had this long thing from a philosopher talking about how Ed Wood's film had an intriguing glow of decay, and how when you watch an Ed Wood film, you were on the edge of a subterranean universe. I like that. I like that image, and that's probably true. But really, wasn't there also, and this is what Joey and I were talking about earlier, wish you were up here and we could all talk about it, the economic imperative, we can't forget that. We can't forget the fact that he was making this sort of a film because he thought he could make some money.
That's right.
I mean, that's one of the reasons.
I'm sure that the bed that eats was made with the intent of having a hit.
Yes, and it's a high concept. Great high concept.
Yeah.
You can describe it in a sentence. Yeah, it's a bed that eats people.
Oh, yeah. Plus, in 1972... there was a pretty good popular rumbling about demonic possession, and that's what motivates this bed.
Oh, you know, you're right. That's Exorcist time, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And this and the original shooting would have predated Warner's release of The Exorcist.
Wow, yeah, you're right. And was that around the time of the car and all of that, or was that later on?
Pretty much in that same period.
Yeah,
but in that same period. And, of course, I doubt that Warner Brothers ever got wind of Deathbed. I'm sure they would have squelched that just like they put the Black Exorcist out of business.
Really?
Oh, Abbey, you know.
Yeah, Abbey, right, sure.
Right.
But Abbey got some sort of a distribution, did it not?
It got some distribution, and then it got very, very quietly yanked.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I see. But Abby's a pretty good picture.
Abby's yeah, sure.
You know, a very and the narrative is good in that. The narrative line.
The narrative is good. The it's a better picture than say Beyond the Door.
Yes, yes.
Which
I agree.
Trades on the same superstitious nonsense, and it was a hit because people thought there was another Exorcist.
Right, right. Well, this was not a hit. Deathbed, the bed that eats, was not a hit. It was a miss, and I'd like to know more about it. I wish the director had been a little more forthcoming about just what was going through his head when he made this picture.
Yeah.
And, as you say, made it over a period of years, which we all know how that works. I mean, you and I have both had projects that have taken years to do, going back
That's
and forth.
Right.
I mean, we understand that. But and it does have a certain amount of cohesion. There's a hippie vibe to it, just like in, to me, even though it's set in the 20s, there's a hippie vibe to Lamora as well.
Uh-huh.
But again, it's that mixture of art and exploitation that fascinates me about films like this. And, you know, a guy wants to be taken seriously, but he figures, well, if I can be taken seriously by throwing a little flash of breast, you know, that's just part of the package. I think really, I'm really going off on a rabbit chase here, but there was a William Mishkin film I actually saw in the theater. It's called Love In, I think, 72 or something. Are you familiar with the picture?
Yes, yes.
And it was, you could tell it was initially a very heartfelt, I'm not going to say art picture exactly, but a heartfelt picture about a guy, moral dilemma, but he was drafted and his moral dilemma about whether to go into the service or not, or go to Canada and all this. And I guess the only place he found to sell it, the only distributor he found to sell it to was Mishkin. And Mishkin took it, and then at intervals while the guy was telling the story, cut in these long segments of hippies having sex and talking about their
cue
old
the
friend.
Orgy scene.
Cue the orgy scene. And then at some point during this, someone says, "Hey, whatever happened to Billy?" And they flash back to him again. This is the kind of thing that was going on in the early 70s. And this is the kind of thing I think maybe the bed that Eads was trying to do. I don't know what the Bad Deeds was trying to do.
No idea what it was trying to do. I have an idea. It was attempting to capitalize on the so-called new freedom.
Yes.
That had taken hold of the film industry since about 1969.
And it's also kind of winking at the camera, which is always hard for me when one of the women in there says something. I sure hope there's not a maniac around. Those sorts of lines, and then superimposing breakfast, lunch, and dinner over different parts of the picture. I don't know that I can really say that I can recommend the picture, but it's certainly interesting.
Well, it's certainly a forgotten horror, except there is now a nice digital video edition.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people are discovering that because of the availability coupled with the underground movie reputation.
It does have that reputation. And I have to say, Joey's sitting here right behind me while we're talking about this, and he really likes this picture. Would you like to tell us why you like this picture, Joey? Would you like to step right up into the microphone and tell Michael and me?
Well, you know, I don't really know how to explain my love for this movie. I think just the fact that it has a vibe that I've never, experienced in anything else, really. It's just strange.
Oh, yeah, I felt that way about, the first Louis Buñuel pictures I saw.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like it has an interesting, like a Samuel Beckett vibe to it also.
Instead of waiting for Godot, you're waiting for something to happen.
That's true. Yeah, there's just, I'm very happy to listen to you guys talking about it because I can't really put into words, and having two people struggle to sort of explain it is cathartic to me.
Well, yeah, it's not easily subjected to a synopsis.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
There are elements in it that recall, I think it's, well, you know, I mean, if this picture is incoherent, then Kenneth Anger's films must be pure chaos.
Strange. That dead odor is gone. The air smells rather sweet now.
All right, let's get to the point of the program where we want to plug stuff, and if folks like hearing the whatever it is that we're doing here, we would like for you to consider supporting us by taking a look at some of the books that we have for sale over Amazon, and Amazon, I guess, is the best place to look for them. What's new with you, Michael, on Amazon?
Oh, man, too many things going on at once. We're working on two new volumes of the Forgotten Horrors books at once, and a spinoff simultaneously.
Right.
I think volume 11 is going to be finished before volume 9, and volume 10 is already in print. So what the hell are we doing here? but no, I was speaking with Steve Bissett the other day, and we were talking about projects, including one that Steve is developing to reprint a bunch of really rare prehistoric monster stories from the early day pulps.
Yes.
That never have been put back into print. He's calling it paleo pulp.
So you're talking about the teens and 20s? Pulps?
Yeah, yeah. And I had just, the reason we were talking, I had just come into possession of an issue of Collier's from 1916 that Steve had been looking for years, containing a hideous prehistoric survival story by Peter Bernard Kine.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Author of, among many others, Three Godfathers.
Peter Kine, yeah.
And so pretty excited about that. I've got an egghead academic book in the works right now based on a huge collection of 19th and early 20th century wanted posters in the possession of the Junior College District in Fort Worth.
Nice. Very nice.
And so, you know, all sorts of things happening at once.
Well, they are.
I just...
And, you know, we don't like to give away when we're doing these necessarily, because I know people are coming to them at different times of the year, not necessarily listening to them the moment we get them out. But this is the Christmas season, the holiday season. And I think I would like to talk a little bit about the radio show that I do with Public Radio Tulsa, which is called Swing on This. And Swing on This is a Western swing program, although we go outside the lines quite a little bit. We play, of course, your Western swing albums, the two albums you did with Diddy Wah Diddy, and Carole Hubbard and Slim Ritchie. And we're doing a Christmas show on Christmas Eve that anyone in the world within the sound of my voice can pick up the program. Because it streams at 7 p.m. Tulsa time, which is Central Standard Time. It streams anywhere in the world. Matter of fact, we had someone write us from the Azores the other day that had picked up the show. And you can do it on your computer, publicradiotulsa.org. And I will be, as I do every year, I will be playing a Michael H. Price song on the program. Not sure which one's going to be yet. There's so many good Christmas songs that you've done, Michael, over the years, but there will definitely be one of those. And if you're looking for Christmas gifts, look at us. We've got some books out there. And if you've got a baseball fan on your list, I've kind of stumbled into something that has been doing real well, which is the biography, as told to a biography of Ralph Terry, the great Yankee pitcher, who asked me to write his life story. It's called Right Down the Middle, and golly, it's been doing really, really well on Amazon. We've been really moving them out, and he's the only pitcher, for you baseball heads, you seam heads out there, he's the only pitcher in Major League history to have thrown the last pitch in two World Series Game 7s. And it's pretty fascinating. He's a fascinating guy, and I feel very blessed to be able to do his story. And looks like we're on the cusp of the new year, and looks like there will be more tomfoolery coming along. But we just want to thank, and I know, Michael, I feel like it's a great blessing to have the folks listening to these podcasts and supporting us with buying the Forgotten Horrors books and the other books we do. It's great. You know, you get a little bit lachrymose or pathetic or however you want to say it this time of the year about people that help you, that you're happy to have around. So we want to thank everybody who listens to these podcasts.
Definitely.
We really appreciate it. Yeah. Anything else we need to go through, or
is that
enough of the cheap sentiment
I'm...
for tonight? You know what Noel Coward said, how potent cheap music is. So there we go. We will be talking to you in the new year then.
Won't be long then.
All right. Talk to you later, Michael.
Back with you soon, Bill.
You bet. Bye.
Shadows cover every patch of ground. Doom emits a frightful sound. An ill wind begins to howl and thrash. The referee does the monster mash. You try to scream, but it's too late. You can't escape the hand of fate. Grim faces regard you with a menacing glance. Slimy things crawl up your pants. A channel that can't be changed mesmerizes you with images that are strange, but true.